guarantee we are signing here today is evidence of the path they will follow. If there is anything certain today, if there is anything inevitable in the future, it is the will of the people of the world for freedom and for peace.
President Harry Truman at the signing ceremony that created NATO on April 4, 1949, 75 years ago today. Diplomats gathered in Brussels this week to mark the anniversary. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg proposed a novel idea then. He wants to basically Trump-proof aid to Ukraine if Donald Trump wins re-election. Trump has railed against NATO, and he accuses European allies of not pulling their weight. On the campaign trail, he threatened to abandon fellow NATO states entirely if they hadn't paid their dues.
One of the presidents of a big country stood up and said, "Well, sir, if we don't pay and we're attacked by Russia, will you protect us?" I said, "You didn't pay? You're delinquent?" He said, "Yes, let's say that happened. No, I would not protect you. In fact, I would encourage them to do whatever the hell they want. You got to pay. You got to pay your bills."
We'll talk about the future now of NATO with Charles Kupchan. He's senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations and a professor of international affairs at Georgetown University. Welcome back to Press Play, Charles.
Good to be back with you.
Okay, so how seriously does NATO take what Trump is saying about it and about basically letting Russia do, quote, whatever the hell they want?
NATO takes it very seriously, in part because Trump is Trump and you never know what you're going to get. He could decide to pull the U.S. out of NATO. He has said he's going to stop aid to Ukraine. And those kind of comments come against the backdrop of a situation in the Congress, the House of Representatives, where Biden's request for a new tranche of aid to Ukraine is currently stalled. And so Europeans are watching this, and they're not just worried about Trump. They're worried about broader political dysfunction in the United States and whether they can count on the U.S. as a reliable ally. I was at the Munich Security Conference a few weeks ago, and my head almost exploded because Germans are now talking about the possibility of acquiring nuclear weapons. Why? Because they're just not sure that when push comes to shove, we're going to be there to protect them.
Wow. Well, also, Germany and many of the European NATO member states have not invested as much in their own defense, right? Because they rely on NATO. And so are they reconsidering how much they spend on their own defense capabilities, given what Russia has done in Ukraine?
Yes, NATO spending as a whole has gone up dramatically. It really goes back to 2014 when the Russians first grabbed hold of Crimea and fostered an uprising in eastern Ukraine. At the NATO summit that year, President Obama got everyone to agree to aim to spend 2% of GDP on defense. Not everybody is there, but everybody is heading in that direction. Germany, importantly, is probably going soon to hit that 2% benchmark, has set aside 100 billion euros, a one-time investment in defense. So yes, the Europeans are doing more, not as much as everybody here in the United States would like. But listen, the Russian invasion of Ukraine has animated European defense spending and defense efforts like nothing else. And yes, Trump's threats have helped. But it's not just Trump who has been twisting arms. American politicians have been trying to get Europe to spend more on defense for decades.
Okay, so the United States also leads what's known as the Ukraine Defense Contact Group, which coordinates military aid to Ukraine. And yesterday, the NATO Secretary General, Jens Stoltenberg, he proposed that the countries that are contributing to it, the NATO states, would pony up $100 billion over 5 years. What's been the reaction to that, both here in the U.S. and in Europe?
Well, as you put it a few minutes ago, this is in part about Trump-proofing. To try to take aid to Ukraine out of the hands of individual NATO governments and vest it with the NATO alliance as a whole in Brussels. Is it going to work? You know, I have my doubts. And that's because I don't think you're going to get the U.S. Congress or other governments, for that matter, to agree to hand over that kind of funding to a body that is basically unelected and unaccountable. That doesn't go over well in the United States Congress. In fact, one of the reasons the U.S. never entered the League of Nations, despite three votes in the Senate shot down each time, was the idea of somehow some international bureaucracy having the ability to tell the United States what to do. But, you know, bottom line here is the situation on the ground in Ukraine ain't good. The Ukrainians are on their heels. The Russians are advancing. The Ukrainians are running out of artillery shells, running out of air defense. They desperately need more aid. My best guess is it's not going to be coming through this new NATO account. It's probably going to come because our House Speaker, Mr. Johnson, cuts a deal with the Democrats and the internationalist Republicans and gets some kind of new package through Congress in the coming weeks.
Right. So he has said this week that he would be open to that, open to loans to Ukraine.
You know, there are all kinds of proposals floating out there. Number one, that some of the assistance is a loan rather than a grant, i.e., no, you, the American taxpayer, you're not on the hook. Another option is that there are about $300 billion in frozen Russian assets, most of it in Europe. But there's talk about using either those assets themselves or the income from those assets to buy weapons for Ukraine. And there's also some talk of a deal whereby the Republicans would get Biden to approve more LNG, liquid natural gas sales from the United States, in return for an aid package for Ukraine. Everything right now is in play. I don't think that the Republicans want to stand by and be blamed for letting Putin take more land from Ukraine. That's one of the reasons that I'm pretty optimistic that we'll see a package passed sometime in the coming weeks.
So stepping back just a little bit, if Russia decides to expand and perhaps go after one or more of the Baltic states or even Poland, I don't know, how would NATO respond?
An attack against NATO territory, a NATO member state, would lead to the invocation of Article 5, which is the collective defense provision in the NATO treaty, effectively obligating other countries to come to the assistance of the attacked party. An attack on one is an attack on all. I don't think that Putin is going to attack a NATO member. He's having a hard enough time trying to win a war against Ukraine alone. If he attacks Estonia or he attacks Poland, Russia is going to be at war not just with Ukraine, but Ukraine plus 32 NATO members. Keep in mind that Finland and Sweden have just joined. That's not a good bet. And that's why I think Putin is actually going to be pretty careful about avoiding a wider war between Russia and NATO.
But is Europe afraid that Putin is spending more militarily as a part of GDP than most of the member countries are, and that Russia poses an existential threat to them, like to France, to Germany? You said earlier that Germany is thinking about acquiring nuclear weapons. Is that because of Putin?
Yeah. I mean, listen, you have to be prudent. Putin has just attacked a neighbor of 40 million people. He is attempting to engage in an imperial land grab and annex a big chunk of Ukraine to Russia. You cannot but react to that. And that's why right now you have planning in NATO. What do we do if Russia attacks Estonia? What do we do? What's the operational plan? And NATO has now forward deployed all across the front line a series of forces, forward deployed forces that are a deterrent against Russia. So is it a high probability event that NATO is going to find itself at war with Russia? No, but NATO has no choice but to prepare.
Charles Kupchan is senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations and a professor of international affairs at Georgetown University. Thanks for joining us again.
My pleasure, Madeline.
Do you feel like you're always working, even at night and on the weekends? Well, a California proposal would force companies to have right to disconnect policies, basically forcing bosses to back off after hours. We'll talk to the bill's author next. And a little later in the program, we'll have your weekend movie reviews. So all of that is coming up next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on 89.9 KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Imagine you're winding down after work. You're sitting back and enjoying, let's say, Jeopardy or maybe dinner out with friends when your phone pings. It's the boss texting you after hours. Should you respond? What happens if you don't? Well, a proposed California state law would give you permission to ignore your boss. It's called the Right to Disconnect Bill. San Francisco Assemblyman Matt Haney introduced it, and he joins me now. Hello.
Hey, good to be with you.
Good to have you. All right. What was the impetus for this?
It's really a consequence of the way that we communicate now and the modern work environment. It used to be that you would go in and clock in and clock out, and you knew when you were on and you knew when you were off. But because of the smartphone and the 24/7 accessibility, we can find ourselves working 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and never having any time that is protected to actually disconnect or even be with our families. So this is, you know, really updating our laws and our policies and our culture to reflect this modern reality of the smartphone in our lives and the work-life balance that needs to be protected in light of that.
So this is aimed mainly at white-collar workers?
It's mainly white-collar workers. It's mainly exempt workers, people who are not paid by the hour, who still may think they signed up for a 9-to-5 job, but it ends up being a 24/7 job. You know, if there's a villain in this story, if we had to choose a villain, it wouldn't be bad bosses, but it would be the technology, which has really changed how accessible we are, and our laws and our policies and our culture and how we work hasn't caught up. And the result of that is that people can find themselves never able to turn off and not being clear when they can turn off. And it hurts their well-being. It hurts their productivity. It hurts their work-life balance, their family life. And I think as much as hard work is an American tradition, so is having some time that's protected with your family.
Well, so you say the villain is really the tech, but you can silence your phone. You can put a DND, do not disturb, on there. Someone knows when you're in a meeting if they're texting you or trying to text you. So there are ways to prevent this kind of ceaseless communication. You can turn your phone off. Why does there have to be legislation? Because some people are saying this is kind of seems like an overreach.
Well, you can turn your phone off, but your boss knows that that it can be turned on. And so they may expect that it will be on. You know, this law is really actually asking the companies to form the policy themselves. It does leave a lot of flexibility for employees and employers to decide what this looks like for them. And if you want your employees or your employees need to work really long hours or irregular hours or night hours or weekend hours, that's all fine. This doesn't stop that at all. It doesn't change that. They can do that. All they have to do is define when people are on and when they're off, and if there's any time that they have that's explicit where they can disconnect. And the employee has to be able to agree to that. This is really just asking them to have an upfront agreement so that there's no gray area that leaves people with no time to disconnect at all. The state here is not telling people they can't call anyone after five. That's absolutely not what's happening, although I realize that's what some of the headlines have said. It's saying that the employer and the employee have to define when you're on and when you're off more clearly, and if there's any time that is agreed to when they can disconnect. And that's what the laws do in over 15 countries around the world, including countries that are growing dramatically and tremendously post-COVID in ways that ours are not, and including in industries like tech. So I think it's an important thing for our state, but it's really not an overreach. It's just asking a company to have a policy on this, or an employer to have a policy, and the employee know what they're getting into and when hopefully they have a little bit of time to check out.
So every business, from like a very small mom and pop up to
public and private. And for some businesses, this isn't all that relevant because they literally do not ask people to do work when they leave. And they could say that. Certainly they could say that it would happen in very rare instances or emergencies or scheduling. They could say that, you know, it would happen only in certain sort of larger deadlines and such. And they could define certain hours when people know that they will be able to disconnect. What we're finding is that when it's left wide open, people can find themselves always on and never off, with no time that's clearly protected to be able to be with their kids, to rest. And that's creating a certain type of strain on so many of our residents that I think is very negative.
Well, how do you operate with your staff? Like, I'm sure that you want to text some of your legislative aides at all hours. And how do you restrain yourself? If you restrain yourself.
Well, I do. And in fact, part of what we hope this bill does is that people have these conversations at the workplace. And we've had more of this conversation. I already, you know, the large majority of time would not contact most of my staff other than my chief of staff in evenings and weekends, unless there was a particular event or big deadline that we all were working towards. But I think we've made some of that more explicit now. And one of the things that we've done, which I think has been helpful, is we realized that there were these larger text message threads that we had as a staff. And I would sometimes send stuff to them. And even if I was just sending information or questions that I expected to be addressed in the morning, some of them might see that and think that they needed to do something on that in the evening or night. And so they were feeling like they had to be responsive to that. So we eliminated those threads.
But do you contact them after the workday and on weekends? Or do you say no, no contact at all?
Very, very rarely. Huh. Other than my chief of staff, who we've discussed this in terms of when she's needed because of the nature of her job, and my communications director, if there is press questions that need to be dealt with off hours. So those are the only folks who get contacted for specific things that I need.
But that would have to be spelled out under your proposal, like at every company, like who would be exempt, who would have to respond after hours and who wouldn't.
Yes.
But that envisions like a lot of foresight that one might not have with how work changes and who's responsible for what. Seems like, you know, there needs to be a lot of flexibility sometimes.
Certainly in the over a dozen countries that have this, and sometimes these are relatively broad descriptions, you know, that you may need to have somewhat irregular or emergency communications during certain hours, and that's the way it's clarified, and they agree to that. You know, or for individuals as part of their work contract, they're more clear about the hours that they need to have disconnected. This type of clarity in these communications, I think, actually will help with the trust and the relationships and the connections that people have at their job site, and also the productivity.
All right. Well, thank you very much for coming on the show and explaining it.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate it.
That's San Francisco Assemblyman Matt Haney, who has introduced a bill known as the Right to Disconnect Bill in Sacramento. Coming up, we'll have your weekend movie reviews, including a new documentary about a camp for girls that aims to teach them to be political leaders. The camp, though, unintentionally delivers another message.
We're asking these girls in this film, and maybe women everywhere, just to settle for kind of empty, patronizing pep talks about how they can do anything, while not actually treating them like equals and letting them do the real work that does let them actually do everything.
That's next on Press Play. Yeah. You're listening to 89.9 KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. It is likely going to be cold in Los Angeles this weekend, so maybe you want to stay inside or go to the movies and avoid the rain. Here with our weekly film reviews are Amy Nicholson, film reviewer for the New York Times and host of the podcast Unspooled. Hi, Amy.
Hello.
And Tim Gerson, senior U.S. critic for Screen International and author of the book, This is How You Make a Movie. Hello.
Hello.
First up, we have a French sci-fi film. It's called La Bête, or The Beast, and it's written and directed by Bertrand Bonello, and it takes place in the year 2044, where people are getting this futuristic medical procedure that purifies their DNA, and it's supposed to help them heal from trauma. And here's a bit from the trailer.
This is the first time I've done this. How does it go?
En purifiant votre ADN, vous avez déjà rosé de vos vies antérieures. Vous nettoyez les traumatismes dont vous avez hérité depuis des siècles.
Okay, so that is French actress Léa Seydoux hearing about this procedure, and the man there is explaining that this allows people to explore their past lives and resolve their traumas from centuries ago. So I guess the movie bounces around from time period to time period. Tim, what did you think?
I'm a fan. Yeah, it does bounce around from three different time periods. It looks at these two characters played by Léa Seydoux and George Mackay in 1910 in Paris, in 2014 in Los Angeles, and 2044 in a dystopian Paris that we heard a little bit from in that trailer. And it's based on the Henry James novella, The Beast in the Jungle. And one of the things I really liked about the film is we have so many movies about the encroaching technological advancements that are going to destroy society as we know it, whether it's The Terminator or The Matrix or whatever. But The Beast does it in a very different way, which is to tell it through a love story. But in all three stories, what we're actually seeing is that people, in their own ways, will cut themselves off from the feelings that they have because they're afraid of their own feelings, because they're afraid of love. And so the idea of the beast is this idea of this sort of unknown force that's going to destroy us in any lifetime that we live. And so the movie is a horror movie, a sci-fi film, a period costume romantic drama. There's a lot of different genres that Bonello is playing with, and the movie has this sort of playful, sort of inquisitive spirit, and it bounces around from these different types of tones and styles. I'm a pretty big fan of The Beast, yeah.
So is The Beast us, our inner us? Is that what it is, Amy?
I think The Beast is our inability to control our own fear, our own negative emotions that keep us from happiness. You know, that was definitely the focus of the original novella. And I think it's very smart here how Bonello has expanded this into a sci-fi film, you know, which is, of course, not in the original book. I just got a little bit restless sometime in the execution, because it is also one of those films with a little bit of a ponderous pace. People talk very slowly. It's very heavy on the metaphor. But there are moments in it that I like a lot. And it is a very much a star showcase for Léa Seydoux. And you have these scenes where, you know, you get the flashy stuff. You zoom into her face and get to see her cry in one take. You see her turn her face into something mask-like. There's a lot of invention happening, even if I do get... Sometimes I just don't have the tolerance for a movie that has dramatic close-ups of a pigeon's face. But I do like a movie that, you know, has invention. Like
what if it was a kitten's face? Would you have a better reaction?
Maybe. I mean, nothing against pigeons. I like pigeons a lot. They're probably smarter than most kittens, if we're going to be honest about it.
That's true. But yeah, you're saying it just can be a little too impressed with itself.
It can for my taste. But then I think Tim is a bit more highbrow than I am.
I'm also more pro-pigeon, I think it sounds like the name he is. So.
The Beast is in limited release now. Up next, we have the new action thriller Monkey Man, starring Dev Patel, and it's also his directorial debut. It's set in Mumbai. He plays a fighter who's seeking revenge against a powerful group of men after the murder of his mother.
Who is he?
Nobody. Just some crazy kid from the gutter.
He has to be extinguished.
Before your nobody becomes a somebody. Just one small ember can burn down everything.
Make them remember your name.
All right, Amy, this is a very violent trailer, and it seems like there's a lot in this. There's an underground fight club, class warfare, some social commentary on the corrupt elitism in India. What did you think?
Yeah, it is a very, very, very violent movie with great fight scenes, very strong imagery, an interesting setting. And this is a movie that in many ways you've seen a million times. It even name checks John Wick in the dialogue just to announce its intentions, which is a bit of a mistake because it's not quite John Wick. You know, I tune out when a movie like this just is either, it casts all the women in it as either idealized mothers or sexual trafficking victims. You know, that's just boom, yeah. I check out. But the setting really does keep our interest. You know, these tiny car chases on streets that are standing in for Mumbai. Like, there's a villain who does yoga to prepare for a conflict. And the fights themselves, I have to say, are fantastic. I mean, they are shot and they are edited and they are choreographed so well that they almost just feel like they came in from a different movie. You know, there's a little bit that I won't spoil, but it involves a mouth and a knife. And when it happened, I just wanted to applaud. It was fantastic.
A mouth and a knife?
A mouth and a knife. And it is just like, wow. Ooh. And Dev looks fantastic in the fights. You know, he really is an actor that I like a lot. I like him a lot. He's a person just, you know, I like to stare at him and ask what he's thinking. But the movie itself, oh, I just wish it didn't feel so familiar, despite everything about it announcing that it's a completely original thing.
Tim, what did you think?
Yeah, Amy is not incorrect about the mouth and the knife. And in my audience, people actually did applaud in that moment. One of the things I'm frustrated by with Monkey Man is that Dev Patel has talked about the importance of weaving in Indian culture, Indian mythology, the Indian class system into the movie because those things are close to his heart, and he feels like those things help elevate this from the other types of action movies that we see. And my complaint is I feel like all of that ends up being not very compelling because it's really just sort of window dressing for a story that's very, very, very familiar. And so I will say this, as somebody who's also a big Dev Patel fan, I could not think of a better sort of resume reel for him being the next James Bond than this movie. I think that he is a very, very striking action hero, and he's never really done that before in a movie. Yeah. So he carries that, but the whole movie feels like a reel to show people that he can do this type of movie. I'm very curious to see what he directs next.
Monkey Man in wide release today. Next, we have a documentary called Girl State. It follows a group of teen girls in Missouri who start a mock government, and that follows the similar documentary from 2018 called Boys State, and here's a clip from the trailer.
Girl State is like high school teenage girls who care about government.
Are you friends?
Let's knock out. We'll become friends.
Yeah, obviously.
In 2040, I intend to run for president.
So I think Girl State, I'm going to run for governor.
Attorney general.
Supreme Court justice.
But I'm not one to be left on the dust.
Okay, Tim, this was filmed in 2022, right after we first learned about the Supreme Court's decision to overturn Roe v. Wade. And I, Tim, really liked Boys State. What did you think of Girl State?
I really like Boys State as well. I think Girl State is very good as well. It's the same filmmakers, Amanda McBain and Jesse Moss. What's especially interesting about Girl State is that this Girl State in Missouri took place the exact same week as Boys State did in Missouri. And so what's the interesting wrinkle about this documentary is that while it's primarily about the Girl State experience, the teenage girls in the documentary notice what's going on at Boys State simultaneously because they're basically on the same campus. And what they quickly discover is that Boys State has more amenities. They have more resources than Girls State does. And also, Girls State, as we see in the documentary, is partly about forming a government, but it's also about talking about empowerment of women and also building their self-confidence. And while those things are important, it's fascinating how the teenage girls at Girls State are like, why are we being treated with like kid gloves where the boys at Boys State actually get to do the thing they're here to do, which is to put together a government and make laws? That's the whole point of Girls in Boys State. I think both of these movies work really well as companion pieces to each other. I think if anybody was a fan of Boys State, they should definitely check out Girls State. And if you've not seen Boys State, I almost be tempted to say to people, watch that first and then see this one, because the contrast between the two is really, really interesting.
Amy, I'm really curious how the girls interacted versus how the boys interacted, because I remember there was a lot of drama in the boys' version of this, a lot of backstabbing going on.
There is. You get to see lots of different types of what female power can look like and how the psychodrama can work in a small group like that. You know, you have the girls who are known for being too aggressive, too bossy at their school, being like, I'm going to stick to that. You have another girl who, her kind of way of soft power is that she's just going to be incredibly likable. She's going to befriend everybody, and she's going to do that almost like cheerleader pep talk thing. And it's always worked for her in the past. And now the question is she going to be able to pull that off in a group of girls that's like more serious about their intentions to talk about politics? And it really takes into a question I think is like so fundamentally important right now when we're trying to talk so much about equality, which is, yeah, we've been asking maybe we're asking these girls in this film and maybe women everywhere just to settle for kind of empty patronizing pep talks about how they can do anything while not actually treating them like equals and letting them do the real work that does let them actually do everything. And I'm just a huge admirer of these filmmakers. You know, Amanda McBain and Jesse Moss have made several of my favorite documentaries over the last decade, not even just Boys State, which I loved. They're just phenomenal. And their body of work is just incredible at this point.
Okay, Girls State, streaming on Apple TV Plus beginning Friday. Last, we have a coming-of-age romantic comedy called Musica. It follows a guy named Rudy who is looking for love but tortured by music.
For as long as I can remember, everyday regular sounds, I turn into rhythm.
But honestly, I don't think you actually know what you want.
I'm figuring it out.
Well, I know what I want.
Tell me what it is.
Rudy has synesthesia, and he is constantly distracted by sounds which turn into music in his head. And this is based on the real-life story of YouTube star-turned-director Rudy Mancuso. He really does have synesthesia in real life. Amy, what did you think?
Oh, this is just a delight. You know, as a one-sentence summary, this movie can sound a little bit rote, but it has so much style, so much talent, and so much confidence. You know, Rudy, this is his first film. He's a guy who's kind of come up making puppet skits, music videos that he put online. This is his first movie, but it is so confidently put together that to me, he immediately feels like the real deal, like a person we have to take seriously. Yes, he does his best at the beginning of the film, just plunging us in to show us what it feels like to have synesthesia, where we see him always be distracted by the sounds of the city and he can't help trying to shape them and wrangle them into music. And we also see how he can acknowledge that makes him a bit of a lousy boyfriend. He cannot concentrate on conversations with the women in his life. Mm-hmm. The ending is a bit rushed, because I feel like he's going for something that's honest that maybe he doesn't know what the answer is right now. It's a little bit sped up and tacked on, but the way he tells this story is just fantastic. It is shot and put together amazingly. He has this flair for in-camera effects. You know, it's a low-budget film with just these flashy flourishes, these long takes and these surprising split screen reveals. What you feel when you're watching this film is just the act of him and his team of artists just pulling something off. You know, it's all about appreciating the act of creation and how art gets made, just from the first rattling thoughts in your brain to some stuff that I stopped and had to watch twice. It's just amazing.
Tim, what did you think?
I'm a little bit less high on it. I do think it's really, really charming. And both of the lead performances, I think, are really, really, really great. They're so fun together. And the musical numbers, you know, this is original music. And the music, I think, is really great in the film. As Amy mentioned, the choreography in a couple of the musical numbers is very, very impressive, especially for a first-time director. The movie's about 90 minutes long, and I think the last 30 minutes, it really gets bogged down in problems that the rest of the movie got away from, which is really kind of familiar rom-com trappings and cliches and some sort of predictable things. I won't spoil anything, but the romantic triangle, I think, comes to a head in a way that I don't think works very well. It's the one sequence in the movie where I think Mancuso does not have the confidence to pull it off. I think it's a pretty flawed film, but there's so much to enjoy in it. I will also say this movie is streaming on Prime Video. I saw this in a theater with a pre-packed crowd. It plays like gangbusters with an audience. It's not going to be playing in theaters, unfortunately, but it is a real crowd pleaser.
All right. Musica is streaming now on Amazon Prime Video. Well, that does it for our films for this week. Amy Nicholson reviews films for The New York Times and hosts the Unspooled podcast. Tim Gerson is the senior U.S. critic for Screen International and the author of the book, This Is How You Make a Movie. Thank you both and happy weekend.
Thank you.
Happy weekend to you.
Evan Kleinman is here with the key ingredient for perfect tortillas. That is next on Press Play. This is Press Play on 89.9 KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Time now for our weekly food segment with Evan Kleinman, host of KCRW's Good Food. She has just returned from flour tortilla country, where she was reminded about an amazing and underappreciated ingredient, Sonoran white wheat. Hello.
Hi.
Well, first of all, where is flour tortilla country?
Flour tortilla country is Sonora. So both sides of the border, Tucson and south into Mexico. It's in northern Mexico.
And where were you?
I was in Tucson. I have a lot of relatives there. And it was a good reminder about this flour tortilla tradition, but also this grain, which was brought to that area in the 17th century. And I think it's a grain that a lot of bakers should make note of and play with.
And this grain we're talking about is Sonoran white wheat, named after, I guess, Sonora. And why is it different from your standard flour that you would buy, all purpose?
You know, for the last decade or so, there has been like this resurgence of using old grain varieties. And it is a very regional sort of movement. Every region in the country sort of has created their own local grain sheds. And definitely Sonoran white wheat has made an impact on a lot of those grain sheds in the Southwest and into California. And the reason it's so loved is that when it's milled into flour as a whole grain, it is white. And it also has really delicious flavor notes that one doesn't usually associate with whole wheat. So people who might not necessarily love eating whole grain, you know, breads, Sonora white wheat is a way for people to eat a whole grain and have a more mild kind of different experience.
Is it as nutritious?
Oh, 100%.
Oh, wow. And so you ate it in the form of tortillas.
Well, when I'm in Tucson, I fall into a vat of tortillas. I wrap myself in tortillas. I become a burrito ensconced in a flour tortilla blanket.
So are you saying you prefer the flour tortilla to the corn tortilla?
Not at all. It is so different than what we experience as a flour tortilla. When you're really lucky and you come across the best of the genre, they are big, gossamer thin, and they have this chewy elasticity, despite how tender they are, that like a regular flour tortilla does not have. It's really a specialty of the area.
Can you get them here?
There are a couple places that make this style. Sonora Town does, and La Palma does. And La Palma makes their own flour tortillas now to sell under the brand, I believe, Mejorado.
Okay, that's good to know. But this Sonoran white wheat, this particular form of flour, you don't use it just for tortillas. You can make all sorts of things with it, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And that's what I am advocating. It is a soft wheat as opposed to hard winter wheat, which is what prevails in both the industrial food system and just in wheat growing over North America. We're known for hard wheat Soft wheat has a lower protein profile, which means less gluten, and therefore it is really good for things like muffins, any kind of quick bread, cookies, biscuits, pancakes, cakes. You can make a loaf of sourdough bread that has a fantastic and aromatic crust by subbing out 30 to 40% of your flour for Sonora. I have a ton of links for people on the essay that goes along with our audio segment. So if people are curious about what you can do with it and want to go into a deep dive, I have places to point you to. And of course, that's always at kcrw.com/pressplay. And you can find this particular segment, and there you have it.
Okay, perfect. So I imagine you can use it for pastry because, as you say, it's lighter. It has less gluten. You can use it for, dare I say, pie dough.
You said the magic words.
I did.
It's April. We're finally into the month of April. And yeah. The pie contest is April 28th. And, you know, in talking about this wheat, I reached out to several local grain hounds here in Southern California, one of whom was, of course, Roxana Julepot, who, with her husband Dan, owns Friends and Family in Hollywood. She's also written a just unbelievable book, a cookbook called Mother Grains. And she was generous enough to share a brand new recipe for pie dough made of 100% Sonora white wheat. It's a recipe that's going to be in an upcoming book of hers, but she said, here, you can post it on the KCRW website. How awesome is that?
Oh, that is awesome. So again, go to kcrw.com/pressplay, find this segment, and you will find that recipe. So if people want to try it out, bake their own pie dough, perhaps enter the Pie Fest with it, and want to use this Sonora white wheat flour, where can they buy it?
It is easily found online. Many regional mills have it. But why not support our local mill in Pasadena, Grist and Toll? I mean, if you actually go to Grist and Toll to buy the flour, you can have a really wonderful conversation with the people who work there, and you'll learn a lot. They know so much about using all of these whole grain flours.
Okay. Sonora white wheat flour. Go check it out at Grist and Toll in Pasadena. Also, check out our website at kcrw.com, where you can also sign up to participate in Pie Fest. That's kcrw.com/pie. Evan Kleiman is the host of KCRW's Good Food and our resident pie maven. You can listen every Saturday morning at 10 o'clock. And Evan, what's on your show this week?
We do a deep dive into the onion, its culture, traditions, and historic recipes, along with the dark side of modern onion farm production. Then famed pastry chef Sherry Yard stops by to talk about what makes a great hand pie, which is one of our new categories at the contest this year. And we talk to a wonderful Bangladeshi cookbook author about food of that region.
All right. Thank you, Evan Kleiman.
Thank you so much, Madeline.
On Monday, a total solar eclipse will trace a path across most of the United States, moving from southwest Texas through the Midwest, upstate New York, and eventually to the tip of Maine. It can be an awe-inspiring experience seeing the sky darken and the jet black moon creating a ring of fire when it covers the sun. We, as in humans, we know it's coming. But it's going to catch animals by surprise. The last time a total solar eclipse crossed North America in 2017, scientists and zoologists saw some curious and perhaps even some shocking behavior. Birds suddenly went quiet, giraffes galloped anxiously, giant tortoises even started mating. Now researchers are flocking to zoos to see what all creatures great and small might do this time on Monday. Allison Provo is the curator of mammals at the Riverbanks Zoo and Garden in Columbia, South Carolina, and she was at the zoo 7 years ago. Welcome.
Why, thank you.
Well, what did you see back in 2017?
Well, you know, it's been a while, but we definitely saw a lot of different things. So one thing that I always like to kind of make sure there's a little bit of a caveat with this is there was a lot of disruption to these animals' daily routine. We very much marketed ourselves as a destination to be, and we had these researchers coming to do this study. And so we had massive crowds that day. So there was a little bit of a disruption to the animals' routine in that the crowds were probably triple to quadruple what they normally would see in a busy day.
Yeah, so that was a little weird for them to begin with.
It definitely was. You know, that being said, we had done some observations on the animals prior to this so that we could have some data to compare to. And so we did see some interesting things. So around the time it started getting dark and leading up to totality, we did actually see the giraffe, for example, moving towards the back of their exhibit and kind of pacing in the back corner. And what's interesting is that corner is where their shifting gates are. And giraffes are very much creatures of habit. And so as it got dark, it seemed like they were using some of those evening behaviors that they used to tell us, okay, it's time to come inside. It's time for dinner. and we saw that through a few species. So we actually saw the gorillas do a similar thing where some of the gorillas moved towards their shift doors. And then on the flip side, we actually saw some of our animals who sleep more during the day start exhibiting some signs that they might start waking up for the evening and doing some more behaviors, such as our Malayan tapir. We also observed the grizzly bear got up at the time of totality from sleeping. But again, some of those external factors at the time of totality, we actually had a huge cheering and applause from the crowd. And then some fireworks actually went off a block or so from the view.
So that disrupts anyone's sleep patterns, even a grizzly bear's. What about the tortoises then and their increased sexual activity?
So the tortoises was kind of a funny one. So the tortoises, I believe they were pretty much doing their base behaviors, but then right before totality, all the tortoises had kind of moved together, and then two of them did in fact begin mating. I don't know that I necessarily believe that that is because it became dark, because to be honest, tortoises are not shy creatures. And so it's not unusual for them to mate multiple times throughout the day, especially the Galapagos tortoises. So, you know, I don't know if it's because it got dark or it just happened to start at that same time, but we'll never really know.
Oh my gosh, I didn't know these slow moving animals were so active.
Yes, certain times of the year, they certainly are.
Well, in general, do you notice that the animals seem a little more anxious during the eclipse?
There were some species that we did feel we were seeing some anxiety behaviors. You know, giraffe definitely were one of them. The tapir was one of them. Some of the bird species, we actually interestingly saw the same thing. We saw where their activity may have increased, such as the lorikeets, their activity levels increased. And then as it got dark, they actually all flew in mass in a giant group to their indoor enclosures and nest box. So it definitely seemed like they were affected by the fact that it was getting dark.
That's what I've heard, that animals, or that birds rather in particular, they stop singing, they stop tweeting when this happens. Did you notice that?
We did, yeah. And not just with our birds that are in our collection, we did actually notice that just in nature as well. So our zoo has this beautiful section behind it where we're butted up right against a river. And so we had a nice woods back there. And so lots of wildlife living back there. And usually you can see the native birds flying around. You can hear them singing their songs throughout the day. And actually we did notice that all of that went quiet. And then actually an interesting thing was the crickets and the cicadas started chirping. So we started hearing those evening frog insect noises that you would hear if you were sitting out on your back deck in the evening.
I guess it makes sense. It gets dark. They think it's nighttime. But then it's over after a few minutes and they go back to their normal behavior?
Exactly. You know, some animals, it took a little longer than others to maybe resume those normal behaviors. Some of the species, there definitely was a thing like the giraffe had been in that back corner and then the light came back and you could kind of see them slowly return to using the rest of the exhibit. Like they realized, oh, it's not nighttime. So while it was a little different than when like a big storm comes through or clouds block the sun, it seemed like most species that were possibly affected by this darkness did then ultimately just resume what they would have been during the day.
Right. And are you expecting crowds again on Monday?
You know, I don't think we are going to get too many crowds because we're not really in the path. I believe people have probably flocked all the way up to the Northeast to go see those animals up there.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's Allison Provost, curator of mammals at the Riverbanks Zoo and Garden in South Carolina. And that does it for this week on Press Play. Our producers are Angie Perrin, Bennett Purser, Zeke Reed, and Jack Ross. Brian Hardzinski was our line editor this week. Amy Ta is our digital editor. Sarah Sweeney is our managing producer, and she loves animals. Our technical director is Super Mario Saavedra. I'm Madeline Brand. Thanks for listening this week. I'll be back with you again on Monday.